Today is Friday, August 11th, 2006. I am Sandy Fehler, an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I'm interviewing Marita Weiss, who retired in 2002 with emeritus status after being affiliated with the UW-Madison since 1963. She retired from the position of Graduate School Associate Dean and Director of the Research and Sponsored Programs Office. Hello.
Hello.
We're going to start with questions on your early life, where and when you were born. If you would talk about your childhood, your early schooling, did you have any brothers and sisters? What did your parents do? Were there other people in your life that were mentors as far as you were concerned?
Boy, that's a broad start. First of all, I was born in Chicago, Illinois on September 23rd, 1941. And grew up in the same house on the north side of Chicago and went to Chicago Public Schools. I was the youngest of three. I have an older sister and an older brother. And maybe unfortunately for me, they were both very good students. So by the time I got to school, I followed them into the same elementary school and the same high school. And the pressure was always on to perform as well as those other two. I grew up in a neighborhood where we had a lot of kids. And I was the younger end of the group. I remember my father telling me at one point during World War II, he was some sort of warden for the neighborhood. And he told me that on one city block in Chicago, there were 44 kids. You know, we just always had a ball. There was always someone around to play. There were more boys than girls, and I tended to be a tomboy. Played more baseball than I ever played with dolls or any of that kind of thing, and I climbed more trees. I didn't fall out of any trees or hurt myself in any way. But it was an accident of location. In Chicago, you walked to school. There wasn't any of this busing kinds of thing or integration. So, and I happened to go to a school where there were some very forward-thinking teachers and a principal. And I was in an experimental class where they taught mathematics. And they taught us one way and they taught the other half of the grade, because there were so many of us, a different way. And they found out one was better than the other. And the same with reading. I unfortunately wasn't in the better reading skills, but I was in the better math skills along those ways. And there were teachers there, I remember. In fact, my brother and sister and I, we talk about some of those teachers that we had that made a mark on you. And the eighth grade teacher was in particular. She was a Miss, Miss Zimmer, but boy, she had high standards and she made you work to them. She was very good for all of us. And in high school, some of the same things. I had a teachers thought I should be a teacher. At the time, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
What did your parents do?
My father was an accountant and an officer in the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, and my mother was a housewife. My father's mother had to go and support the family. My father's father was killed by an automobile in 1910. Now, that was quite unique, even then in Chicago. He got off of a streetcar and was hit by a car coming around. Anyway, my grandmother basically was an undegreed accountant. She kept books was very successful. My father remembers cars coming to pick her up from companies to take her to work and things. She was successful up through the 20s and lost everything in the crash. So, and the other influence in my life was the fact my mother passed away when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And my father, I being the youngest, and I was the only one left at home. My brother was a senior in college and my sister was married. And so it was just the two of us for 2 years. And he probably had a lot of influence on how I look at things and evaluate things today. I know my sister and my brother both comment on that, that they'll, I'll say something and they'll say, "You sound like Dad." In there.
Did you know at an early age that you were going to college?
Basically, yes, because my sister and my brother went. My father said we were all going to go to college. My mother thought boys only went to college. And I guess there was a little family tug of war when my sister, who was the oldest, mm-hmm. wanted to go to school. Mother said no and Dad said yes. And she went. And she went away for 2 years and commuted to Northwestern her last 2 years. And my brother found a scholarship so that he could go. And Dad was never rich. We were comfortable, mm-hmm. But he was never rich. And so my brother ended up at West Point.
Oh.
And spent 4 years there and graduated. And he did 6 years in the military and then got out. Mm-hmm. He didn't make a career of it like some of the West Pointers. But that was pretty exciting as a kid. I got to go there and went to military balls and got all dressed up, you know, as a teenager. Because he's 5 years older than I. And it was pretty exciting for a young kid.
So when did you pick what college you were going to?
Well, my senior year, you start looking around. And I looked at small schools and big schools. And at one point, I announced I was going to Colorado or Arizona. And my father told me, no, I wasn't. This was after my mother had passed away. And he drew a circle around Chicago and told me I could go to school anywhere in the circle. It had about a 200-mile radius. And I knew he didn't want to go to Illinois. I don't know why. I just didn't want to go to Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. And I looked at Bradley, which was a smaller school in Wisconsin. And at the time, I really thought I was going to be a math major. And Wisconsin was very highly rated at that time. Mm-hmm. So it probably was the final thing that swung what got me up here. Dad actually offered me a brand new car to commute to Northwestern if I'd stay home.
Uh-huh.
And everyone in the family said, don't do that. And I wanted to go away for a while. I thought I'd go away like my sister for a couple of years and come back, but I didn't.
So you came here in what year?
I came here in 1959 as a freshman,
uh-huh.
and spent 4 years. And in fall of 63, I came back, was starting a finance program and after my bachelor's degree, and we needed work. My father paid for all 4 years. In that respect, I was probably a cut above some of the people around, and lots of folks have teased me that I was a spoiled brat during that period of time. My senior year, my father remarried, which was the best thing that ever happened to him, and maybe to me. It gave me options for when I graduated on what I would do. If he had not done that, I probably would have ended up back in Chicago to be nearer to him and to see if he needed anything. As it turned out, he and my stepmother were married for 29 and a half years and had a great time.
Hmm. Now, how did you like Madison? Did you have a good time as a student?
I had more fun as a student, and I did not get great grades. I learned how to play bridge. In 59, we went to the Rose Bowl, and we didn't fly then. You took trains.
Sure.
So there was this 2.5-day train trip to L.A., which is just two trains full of kids. And we sang. There were guitars, and you sang in the club car half the night and played bridge during the day and just relaxed and got acquainted with all kinds of folks. It was a fun experience. It really was.
Sounds like it.
And so in my senior year, we went back again, and I decided I didn't need to go twice and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I still actually see three, four of the folks I met in college. You build some wonderful friendships, mm-hmm. in there. And worked with a lot of the continued, because I stayed at the U, I would see some of my faculty, the professors that I were in my major in business.
So when did you decide you didn't want to be a math major then?
Oh, after my first year, I took calculus, and it just eluded me, I have to admit. And I decided that if somehow I wasn't smart enough or something to make it through to be a math major. I thought I wanted to at some point maybe teach it, and they said you had a they recommended that you majored in it unless you wanted to teach it in elementary school. And so that just changed everything. I was a little lost, and I thought, well, I'll try accounting, which is what Dad did. Mm-hmm. And you entered that your second year, your junior year, you really didn't take in business. There were no freshman classes that I missed. And I loved it. So I thought, well, I think I found it at that point in time. And mm-hmm. then I stuck with it and took the rest of the requirements to get a BBA instead of a BS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then so you went to grad school then?
I started.
Uh-huh.
And I was the first, in September I came back, and Dad said he'd pay the tuition, which had grown all the way to $500 a semester for non-resident tuition. When I started, I think it was $150 a semester. Mm-hmm. And Jim Bauer, he was an accounting professor, said, go down and talk to Ruben Lorenz or Bill Compsey, who were down in the Amin building at the corner of Park and State Street, the old Amin building. And he said, they're always looking for student help. So I went down, and they hired me immediately. And I remember reconciling bank accounts and doing some work, build workups in the trust fund, or learning what pre-audit was about. I have to admit, as a student, I had never, ever thought about what it took to run a university. And it was a real eye-opener.
Mm-hmm.
And they had me auditing some of the student organizations. And after, in hindsight now, I kind of laugh at that, because some of them always got themselves in trouble after I started to work. And I was auditing in Chadburn Dorm, and it was the day that Kennedy got shot.
Oh my.
It was a real experience. And the kids, you know, everybody just dropped and got glued to television sets and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an experience I'll probably never ever forget.
Okay.
And I was really glad I was on campus for it at that time.
Yeah. Now, why did you want to get a finance degree, a master's
degree?
Well,
I spent my summers working at a bank.
Oh.
And my dad knew somebody worked at the bank, and Dad never wanted his kids to work for him. And so this fellow and my father traded kids. You know, I'll put yours to work and you put mine to work, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So, and I enjoyed that, I have to admit it. And some of the men there encouraged me to pursue it. They thought maybe I'd be pretty good at it.
Well, that's nice to hear.
But in that semester, I thought, well, let's see what's out there. And I realized if I went to work in a bank, I had to work 6 days a week. And it doesn't sound like the best thing in the whole world.
Oh.
And at that point, about that point in time, Ruben Lorenz called me into his office and said they would let me continue to take classes, and I could continue to work on any degree I wanted, but I could work full-time.
Hmm.
And if I would be interested, they were offering me an Accountant 1 civil service position.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded pretty good. And in fact, the money that they were offering me was more than any of the banks in Chicago, which is where I thought I was going.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be going back home. So when I dropped the bomb at home that I wasn't going to come back, I was going to stay up in Madison for a couple of years. After the family war, I just got to stay. And at that time, I was living in an apartment with some friends from the dorms, So I had a place to stay, and it was four of us, and it wasn't very expensive. Mm-hmm. It was a great way to live. And so I decided I would take them up on their opportunity. And they told me that Dorothy Kleinfelter was working there, and that I should talk to her if I was concerned about how they were treating women and what kind of opportunities there might be. Mm-hmm. And we did that, which was the first time we met. Mm-hmm. And she said she'd been there a year or so, and that she had been enjoying the work. So I thought, well, okay, I'll try it too. And I ended up in the same office, in at the time called Gifts and Grants, which grew into research and sponsored programs ultimately. Mm-hmm. And they offered me a position on the after the grants are awarded, it's called post award, and we did the accounting, and we would check to see if they met all the rules and regs, particularly from the federal government, before you submitted the final reports, or if you had your favorite faculty members that always overdrew every account they ever touched, and you knew those were going to be a problem. But we had some fun there. I remember one time Bob Erickson and I started the same day, full time. Huh. And one of the jobs we had was to build up some detail for a National Science Foundation grant that was down in Antarctica. And that they had bought like 7 or 8 snow cats. And they were driving them into crevices and the ice sheet down there, and they'd have to get another one. And we were down in the basement of that old admin building with the spiders and the bugs going through old vouchers. It was a real experience. But it was fun. Mm-hmm. And we moved. I started in the old house that was there, and I was there. I was in there for like 3 months, and then we moved to the A.W. Peterson building. Mm-hmm. And it opened in the spring of 64.
Did you keep taking classes?
Not officially. I don't think I did not take another class. I took professional development classes in university administration.
Oh, sure.
There was a 2-year course offered by the University of Omaha, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Which was highly regarded at the time, and I felt very fortunate that the university sent me and paid for it. Mm. To have the opportunity. I know Dorothy got to go. There were a fair number of us that went, and I think it was Mr. Cafferty, who was vice president at the time, that we really thought was beneficial. And it gave you the overview. I always felt that I chose actually wisely in which department of the university I ended up in. They talked about payroll, they talked about purchasing, they talked about trust funds. But in research admin, you had to work with all of those. You got your accounting stuff from accounting, and if you had a problem, you had to go to payroll or purchasing. And you got a broader view of what the university was all about. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think some of the people on campus began to realize that, because many of the folks actually in research and sponsored programs ended up in dean's offices because of that view that they had. Sure. Ability to get your fingers into the Peterson building in each one of those little different spots.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did you stay then with research or with Gifts and Grants?
Well, yeah. It was research admin. We went from Gifts and Grants to research admin to research and sponsored programs. I left in 69, 5 years. And after 18 months of doing just all this detail work, I wasn't real excited about staying. And at the time, I think George Everson was our boss, and he got promoted to the assistant vice president who was in charge of the Peterson building. Mm-hmm. And Len Van Ness became the director of research and admin, and he promoted me to the manager of all the people that did post award, which kept me there. And I got accountant two and accountant three. Mm-hmm. And I forget, Ed Services Assistant three or four, I forget. Anyway, it kept moving. Mm-hmm. And it kept me interested. But then it finally got to a point where I thought, if I had to deal with one more federal auditor or one more federal agency that was going to change its rules and regs, I had it. And was talking to some of our friends that we had gotten to know, and they said the grad school was looking for somebody. And so I applied. And I interviewed with Dean Bach, and he offered me the position. I went up there in March of 69, and then I stayed there until I retired.
And what was the position when you started?
It was called specialist.
Oh, yeah.
And I oversaw their accounting. A grad accounting was what it was called, and we had all the wharf money to account for. And I'd seen some of that when I was down in Research and Min, because it ended up in a gift account. I knew something about what wharf was and how it worked and some of its history. And it was kind of interesting. And they said that would be it. And then I would get involved with the university budget, which I hadn't had anything to do with before. There was a office down the hall in the Peterson building that we knew did budget, but we didn't know that much about it. It was John Horkin. Anyway, he was head of it. And we knew those people, but, mm-hmm. I didn't know. So I thought, well, this would be ability to learn something different. So when I went up there, and they were running, they had an accountant that had brought up an individual system. Grad school made a big investment. They actually had a little IBM computer in the back room and punch cards going through. And mm-hmm. and they it didn't work too well because they were 3 years behind in closing their books.
Oh, my.
They really didn't know where they were with the wharf money. And Dean Bach wanted to know.
Yeah.
So they had, they wanted to bring up a new system, and they had started conversations. At the time, there was the Peterson data processing, and there was the registrar's data processing, and they were separate. Mm-hmm. And one was clearly focused on the students and the things and supported the registrar's activity, and the other one did the accounting and payroll and stuff. And the registrar's group was looking to broaden itself, and they brought in a guy named Catter. I forget his first name. And he wanted to start doing some different things, and somehow got to Dean Bach. Anyway, they had already agreed that they would write a program for us, and we would give up this machine, which I had no, I was not very excited about having to live with this machine, mm-hmm. and to supervise somebody to run it. And so I was all for that. I thought that was a good idea. And I spent time with them trying to, and listening to the deans in the famous university research committee that gave away the wharf money internally, on what kind of information they wanted to come back. A lot of it sounded like what I heard from when I was down in the research office. And then Dorothy had started to work with a computer programmer to build a new system for research and sponsored programs. And a lot of what she had already built, I knew was there. And so we kind of tried to emulate a lot of it over time. And we came up with ways to put all the funds together that one principal investigator had. I mean, you could not sort all the grants the university had by principal investigator. You had to do it by hand. Hmm. I mean, there were silly little things that mm-hmm. needed to be done that were easy fixes. And so after about, I think it took me a year and a half, we got current.
So when you're talking about putting together a system, you're talking about everything, had everything pretty much been done manually, or had they actually put it on this little IBM?
It was on this little IBM that was behind Times.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And the cards were stacked up all over.
Okay.
And it was, part of it was that it was very clumsy. And it, you know, it took a lot of different steps in order to do it. They would then run new reports, and then the staff would figure out how to fix it, and then the fixes would go back, and you'd have to rerun it, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And this was the advent of the 88 card spaces, and that's what you had to live with, and mm-hmm. you had to print them and run them, and there was a key punch back there. This was all in the basement of Bascom, kind of back in the, under the old, there was a lakeside, and there was a big vault down there. In fact, some of the LVM Art Center art was stored under there in a vault.
Oh.
It was like a bomb shelter.
Huh.
And the grad school had gotten all this space. It was also the old B3 of the registrar before the Peterson Building got built.
Okay.
And then the graduate school was on the first floor of Bascom, and then they went to the basement. And they were down there for 12 years, I guess, and then we went to the third floor, the second and third floor. But it was really kind of neat down there.
The business library
moved in after we moved out.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. And but there were some wonderful stories from the riot days. They were there. I got the end of it, parts of it in 69 and until the bomb went off in 70. But they said there was one day one of the gals went upstairs to get the mail, and she went up there and was greeted by a National Guardsman with a rifle. And they said, "Where did you come from?" And she said, "Well, down there, there's 40 people working, you know." And they had cleared the building, and they didn't know they were there.
Oh, my God.
So the colonels and the generals came downstairs, and they discovered that this wonderful place, which was way out, you know, out of the way. And even in '69, when I was there, you would come in and go to work, and you'd find National Guard stored kind of back in the corner. They'd be sitting on the floor, waiting to see if they would be needed.
Huh.
It was really wild, you know. I guess the folks involved at the time, they really loved to tell that story. Okay. What are you doing here? We came to get the mail.
So you were doing system analysis work, really,
at that
right?
point.
Yeah.
And building up. And I was teaching people that were used to dealing with student records how to do an accounting. You know, I'd say this column and should add to this, take this column and add it to this column and give me a total. And then make sure it cross foots. And they'd look at me and say, "What does cross foot mean?" You know. So we'd teach them that the sum of this column and the sum of this column has to equal what you got here as a way to make sure all the numbers are right. Because that was partly what was wrong with the other system, is that you did all that by hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we did bring up a new system. And I guess then when the university took those two administrative units and combined them,
mm-hmm.
then it went online, which was another fast improvement, that you could do something and see the answers almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And Dorothy created ESIS, we were GESIS, and Ag created their Frank Kuster out in Ag used the same principles for some of the land grant money, and he created it was probably Ag, AG ESIS.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting that all these different programs, the bottom line was there was a basic need that all of them had. It was about 75% of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we shared it across time, mm-hmm. which was really a time saver, and I'm really glad the university was capable of doing that.
Right.
I don't know how much of it they do anymore. And then, in my spare time, I did learn how the university budget worked. And I managed to figure out how to put one together. And how the you know, the pay raises worked and what kind of support I needed to give Dean Bach in order to make that function. Mm-hmm. And he was so supportive. He really was throughout it all. And in, because like in 73, I think, when the University of Wisconsin was merged with the state universities, mm-hmm. They wrote this rules and they created the academic staff then, mm-hmm. quote unquote. And he volunteered me to be on the system academic staff role writing committee.
Oh.
And I would sit there and say, I'm not sure I know how to do this. And he said, sure you do. You know, and go work on this. You know, and it was, I know there were people from Milwaukee and Madison, and I can't remember where else, and we wrote, there was about 10 of us, and we worked together. We'd meet once a month, and we wrote the system rules.
Wow.
The first run-through. And we would negotiate, you know, and we went, well, you can't do that. Well, it, you know, we'd sit there, and Madison needed this, and Milwaukee didn't. And we said, well, put it in there. You don't have to do it. But don't, let's not write a rule that prevents us from getting to where we wanted to go. And there was a fair amount of that kind of give and take that had to go on as we went through this. But it was kind of fun. And there was, there were like three of us academic staff and three faculty.
Mm-hmm. The first rules for academic staff after the merger.
Yes. We got together, Irshane appointed the committee and chaired it and led us through the various steps of it. And then he gave us a lot of leeway and told us to go away and work on this and then come back and bring them up to date. He did not attend the meetings, regularly. But we negotiated between Milwaukee and then New System at the time. They really didn't know exactly what they wanted to do either. And Madison, those were the key players. And we came up finally with a set of rules that are part of Chapter 36.
What did you start with?
Blank piece of paper.
that's amazing. That
we knew that you had to have a definitions and that they wanted appointment types. I think that was in the law.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the fixed term and the indefinite, and we had to start defining how you did that and how would you get there. And then you needed an appeals process and you needed a complaint process. I think some of it just came out of the way they wrote the law,
mm-hmm.
in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So that we came up with chapter headings, and then we started working our way through and trying to decide, should the dean have 10 days or should the dean have a month to think about things before he made decisions about appointments and appeals. And it was also desired to have peer review for, like, indefinite appointments, so that created how those indefinite committees that reviewed those documents got appointed and who was on them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, initially they were appointed because we didn't have anybody that had indefinite appointments. But gradually it started being filled with the kinds of peers that we foresaw that would be needed in those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we got all done, and I thought, oh boy, gee whiz, this is great, we're done. And then by then I think Irshane had gone off to Washington, to the University of Washington. So Serena Pondrum picked up the problem and appointed another committee and said, well, you folks that wrote the system rules have to help us interpret the Madison rules. So I ended up on another two-year stint to sit and write those rules. And we met, actually worked hard, we met once a week from 3 to 5 on an afternoon. And as those were coming together, in fact, Bernie Cohen was vice chancellor at the time, and he would come up and, where are you folks? How are this is going? And we would stay, if he was going to come with us frequently, we would stay till 6 and bring him up to date and where we were and how things were going to get put together, kind of thing.
That's impressive. That certainly was an important thing to have happen on the campus.
Yeah, I was proud of the fact that it worked out as well as it did.
Yeah. Well, how did your position in the grad school change over the years?
Well, as I said, Dean Bach kept volunteering me and pushing me in various directions. And at one point, I remember him coming in and saying that he wanted to appoint somebody to the position of assistant dean. And I thought, oh, shoot, I got to work this thing up again. And he looked at me and he said, it's you. And I'm probably one of the few people that had to do their own paperwork for a promotion. Because at the time, that was my job, was personnel, budget, and accounting to do that. And so I think it was 74, I was promoted to assistant. And then in somewhere 82 or 3, somewhere in there, he promoted me to associate. And it always grew. There was a point in time where the admissions, when people were going to go do an online system rather than the paper one that we had. And he put me on that committee to work. I didn't know anything really about admissions. I knew the people that did it. And had Lorraine. I'd worked with Lorraine Mythaler, and she was the overseer of all that, of admissions and degrees and academic progress and things like that. And he said, "You sit down and work with them," because I had been working with accounting. We had the online systems. I'd worked with Bill Kenyon and Jack Dewey. To do some of those kinds of reports. And he also knew that I could get some things done, because there was a point in time at when we had a $4 million fellowship grant, and I didn't have anything to do with fellowships either. But they came to me and said that there's this annual report you had to do for fellowships, and you needed to take the names of the students and go find out what kind of appointments they had. And they were doing it by hand. They would go to the personnel office and dig their way through all those little cards that we used to have fill out. So I talked to Jack Dewey and I said, you must be able to print me a list of fellows, research assistants, project assistants, and trainees. And he looked at me and he says, I'm probably not supposed to do this, but he did it one night. And he produced, the funny part was he produced a list which probably was maybe 6 inches high. And he said, here's the list. And then he handed me another one, which was maybe 2 inches high, and he said, here's the year list.
Oh, boy.
And it took us a while to get to the point where the year list was only a few pages over, but it took several years before we got to that point. So he said, do this. And I would sit there, and I was listening to some of what their needs were, and so I learned an awful lot about the academic side of the graduate school's office, but I think I saved them. The programmer was from someone that only had done student stuff, and they would talk about, well, you will have to enter this and this, and I'd sit there and say, but I don't have to enter that in the budget system. It is generated automatically by the computer, and this guy sat there and told me it can't be done. And I said, well, why don't you go talk to Jack Dewey? Because it's been done already. And we came up with a system, I think, that served them very well. It ran for 12 years before they started playing with it again and trying to broaden it and do something different with it. And today, it's almost all, it's on the new PeopleSoft. Stuff, but they've brought up working with ADP, they brought up a front end of it, which is, I guess, unique to Wisconsin, and it feeds PeopleSoft, but you can actually apply to the graduate school from anywhere in the world online.
Huh.
And it dumps its right in, it dumps it right into our system.
That is impressive.
And the, in fact, the fellow that wrote it ended up getting hired by the company we were dealing with. But he actually is back at the university. He came back. He said he really didn't necessarily like all the pressure and stuff. He said he could make more money, but that he didn't like the work, and he was smart enough not to just let the money drive him. Mm-hmm. So we feel very fortunate he's back in the grad school leading the InfoTech stuff.
Yeah.
They were very pleased to see him come back. But he was very creative. So there's, you know, 20 years worth, 30 years worth of admissions systems development that occurred. And again, it was Dean Bach. He just kept saying, you know, you can do this, you can do that. And I got so I almost believed it.
Well, what do you consider your major accomplishments?
Well, writing the academic staff rules, I think, is one. And bringing the grad school somewhat out of the dark ages into the modern world of computers and what have you. Training, I think, training a lot of folks that are still there working hard and giving them some of that breadth that I think I developed. I don't know why I was curious. Other folks sat there and just did their job, but that didn't ever work for me. Mm-hmm. I had no why when you got into some of this stuff and how to do it. And then the last, from 94 to 2002, I think I did help bring research and sponsored programs into existence, somewhat bringing it to the grad school, bringing policy. Grad school always did research policy. That was its role. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a vice chancellor. Wisconsin doesn't have a vice chancellor for research. The dean of the graduate school does that job and did it for many years without title. I understand now that the dean does have the title of vice chancellor for research and dean of the grad school. Mm-hmm. And we brought those two activities together before some of the, and I would be a kind of a go-between between the old folks down in Gifts and Grants that I knew, you know, still, and Bob Erickson was there for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And it was a tussle. I mean, there was, why didn't we ask them what their problems were before they made a decision on how to do policy? Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I think I really helped gel some things for the benefit, to the benefit of the faculty members and the researcher people. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was also around a time when the feds were getting crazy and compliance, quote unquote, had to enter in, and you had to check on, recheck human subjects, and we got audited a lot more on some of those subjects. Conflict of interest became such a big deal, and you had faculty members that were owned companies, and they, you know, were they doing this for their company or were they doing it for the university? And they were always being very careful. And then every once in a while, you'd find somebody that was mishandling money in that respect. But we built, Wisconsin's always had a very strong reputation in Washington. I think it's an ethical position, highly regarded. So that, and this just and built on that and improved with it. Mm-hmm. We've been active in groups like the Council of Government Relations since the 60s, that group's been going. They work with agencies trying to streamline rules and regs. We've had, three or four different people that have always been on the board of directors for that particular organization. We were one of the first to sign up for what was called the Federal Demonstration Project, and that was a way, that's been an attempt to streamline rules with the feds. It has all federal agencies there, and it had 60 universities, most of them the big ones. Oh, and it did start with the 60 largest ones. Mm-hmm. That's where it did start. We've ended up improving a lot of the National Science Foundation rules and regs and some of the NIH ones. And those are the two biggest sources of money at UW that we have. Between those two, they probably represent 75% of the money that comes in. And then from there, you have the Army, Navy, and Air Force. NASA, that's, we've also, our space science program's very strong. Mm-hmm. And you, we also got some of the agencies to talk to each other. You know, and why does NASA ask me this question and NSF never does? You know, and we started finding out NASA's asked that question for 30 years and now they don't know why they ask it. You know, but they still ask it. And they asked, we got them to think and start talking to them themselves and then to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the differences have been streamlined. And I was glad to be part of that. And I chaired a couple of committees as part of the federal demonstration group. One was a finance committee. One was a procurement committee. We were trying to simplify some of the ways that the government writes contracts with the universities. There was another group. Intellectual property, that was another one we were trying to work on. Mm-hmm. And with, of course, with WARF, everyone looks to Wisconsin for answers for some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Because they've been such a leader over time. That's really been, WARF has been an outstanding contribution to this university. And I was very pleased and proud to be part of that interaction and to facilitate some of that. Mm-hmm. And it's really grown, actually, since I've left. When we thought the grant was good size when it was $20 million, and now it's, you know, I read in the paper that they're throwing $50 million at this and $30 million at that. And,
now, you've mentioned a number of challenges. What would you consider some of the biggest challenges that you dealt with in your work?
Well, some of the bigger challenges were people.
Ah.
Personnel.
Uh-huh.
No, I don't want any part of them. But,
isn't that interesting, though, when you think about it? Because, I mean, you had some major responsibilities and, you know, major assignments. And personnel.
It's what sticks out in your mind. It's the most unpleasant.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it.
Huh.
You do something and people are unhappy and they, you know, I'm gonna sue you. But well, I don't know. Where would I go with that?
What kept you awake at night?
Whether I was going to get it all done on time, part of it. Who was going to do what, along some lines, and then whether I would work to solve a problem, but and then I have the wonderful position, I think it's an asset, not to worry about and second guess it after I did it. Mm-hmm. And I think people should not do a lot of that. You know, I wish, you know, they say, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done it. But you did it, and you're just going to have to run and roll with it. Mm-hmm. That's something I think my father taught me, mm-hmm, big time, to accept it and do that.
Did you have mentors on campus?
Oh, I was lucky. I just had everybody. Ruben Lorenz was a mentor. He was very proud of Dorothy Kleinfelter and I, trying as two professional women that first showed up in the administrative structure. Mm-hmm. And he was very supportive. And we see him even now. He still is. And he would, if we had a problem, we could talk to him. George Everson was another one. If we had problems, we could always, I could count on calling George and getting good advice. And he was never too busy. and he always wanted to give you credit. That was the other thing. You know, some folks you work with and they want all this glory. And I was fortunate, I worked with a number of people that would always stand there and make sure everybody understood that they didn't do it alone and that they were, you know, they were more than willing to help you. And Eric Rudy was one. He helped me with getting involved nationally with some of the organizations that I had succeeded in doing. And Bob Bach was wonderful. He was patient. He would explain things to me. He'd give me the history on how we got somewhere. And he always said, here, try this. This will be new and different. Try this. And some of it, it might have been the smartest thing he ever did to keep me there. He knew I wouldn't get bored.
Mm-hmm.
But he really thought that he valued this brain and the ability to do something over sex, or whether you were male, female, he didn't care. He wanted the best people around him. And he made you feel like you were one of the best people around. And then I worked with, you know, people like David Ward was an associate dean of the grad school, who then, you know, moved on to be provost and vice and chancellor. And he knew you. He would trust you. These were valuable, you know, really important. Bernie Cohen was the same. Graduate school actually kind of mentored and grew a lot of folks that became campus leaders over time. And it had to do with the fact that the graduate school was called the all-campus college. And unlike other schools on campus, we didn't teach. We were a coordinating office, basically. We did the academic side. We admitted students. We helped them get through their grad programs, and we granted degrees. But then we did the research end of it. And we oversaw a lot of the interdisciplinary research that was going on. But you would, because of the research and the research money, your tentacles went into every school and college on campus. And you knew what LNS was doing, you knew what education was doing, you would know what CALS was doing. We'd coordinate and work. You do something with land grant money, the CALS, we'll do something with the WARF money, we'll build something good. And med school was the same way. It took longer to bring the med school into that group, but they clearly are there now. And I think Bach was responsible for a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, it trained people in a different way than if you had been the dean of LNS or the dean of business or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because Bach, he's actually sat on a council with Irv Shane. It was the chancellor, the vice chancellor for academic and vice chancellor for admin, and the dean of the graduate school. That was his advisory group, and they would meet once a week.
Mm-hmm. Now, when new chancellors came in,
mm-hmm.
did that affect the grad school, affect your position, affect the culture of the campus administration?
Not really. And I think some of it, to some extent, the grad school, because it was the research school and because of the WARF money, all chancellors were smart enough to know, even Donna Shalala, to talk to folks and to work with the people in the grad school.
Sure.
Donna Shalala shook the campus up over time. And you had Irv Shane and Dave Cronin and Bernie Cohen and Bob Bach that were all retiring. They were all in that same era, and she had a chance to restaff those positions and made me pick different people than Irv Shane might have. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it changed some of the culture. But the strengths of Wisconsin are so vast that it's hard to disrupt them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember Ed Young said that everybody gave him credit for leading the University of Wisconsin. And he always said that if he was in the, got out from in front, the institution would just keep going on its own. That he said, as a leader, you have to worry you don't get run over. Which was an interesting observation.
Very much.
And that's why he felt about it.
Would you talk about the climate for women when you were on campus? Do you think it helped or hindered your participation in campus administration or in getting your job done?
The fact that in the early 70s, the university was starting to try to recognize women maybe helped. It had me in the right place at the right time. But there were some real uphill battles for to try to convince people you knew what you were doing, for one thing. To gain the confidence of some of the folks. But being in Bascom, I never felt that I was at a disadvantage because I was a woman. I got to do most everything I really wanted to try to do. I hardly ever got told no. Sometimes I failed, but I didn't always get told no. So I don't think, I think I was part of that movement. I got put on, when 1980 they did this big study on the status of women. They did an update. I ended up on that committee.
Was that worthwhile? Was that a worthwhile committee?
They were writing a report for the regents, mostly. I think it had some positive effects. It showed that we'd moved a little bit, not a whole lot, and that more work had to be done. And in that respect, the committee was very useful. There were some people, I think there were some women on that committee that hoped it was going to be more of a revolution than an evolution. Mm-hmm. But I really think evolution was the only way it was ever going to work. There were too many men that were going to be uncomfortable if the women moved much too fast mm-hmm. in this respect. And I think that was true everywhere. But it was so different. At least when I first went to the grad school, they would talk about Elizabeth McCoy, who was in bacteriology. Mm-hmm. I think she might have been one of the few women full profs at that time in science. And at least in 1980, there was a big array of folks now, and some of them, the departments had come around and had started to hire some women. I felt like I was able to help that movement rather than to be someone that needed help. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I was probably very fortunate mm-hmm. in time.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other outside activities, outside of your primary responsibilities that you would like to talk about that you think were important to what was happening on the campus? I mean, you were pretty much involved in a lot of governance and academic staff issues and committees in general, and mm-hmm. you probably have you do have that institutional knowledge about the things that were going on all that at that time. Are there other things that you want to talk about?
Not totally. A lot of them we've gotten into. I did some work with Extension, and I got involved with WHA-TV for a while, and I think some of the things that, again, some of the experiences that I had had evolved over into trying to help them. Mm-hmm. I volunteered with out at Central Colony. Hmm. And they had an auxiliary group. There's a wonderful I had an opportunity to deal with, they had forgotten to do the file the income tax return. And I was treasurer the next year, of course. And I thought, why me? You know? So the auditors came. I wrote them this letter and said that this is a volunteer group. And we're not informed on how to do the taxes, and I pleaded real ignorance. And they wrote back and said, fine. Huh. So this was about, and then I was, about 20 years later, I was on the board of the University Insurance Association, UIA, and the then insurance company that was supposed to take care of us forgot to do something with our taxes. Huh. And they were going to pay it right out of our proceeds, you know, on our big $24 a year we had to pay for that insurance. So I told them what had happened the last time I had run into to the IRS in this kind of a nonprofit situation. And their attorneys looked at me in shock, you know, and I said, try it. You know, what, can it harm anything, you know? And they came back, they did try it, and they came back a couple months later and told me it worked.
Oh, my.
Huh. And they let the University Insurance Association off the hook.
Yeah.
So I guess in that respect, I did have, so I helped do a few things.
Absolutely.
With that.
You had mentioned earlier that you got involved in professional organizations. Would you talk about that? How that's helped you over your career? Is it important? Why?
Oh, I do think that's very important for everybody, mm-hmm. for their development. And I mentored a fair number of people as time went on that I could to try to do some of the same things in there. And the first one was the National Council of University Research Administrators, which meets in Washington. And Dorothy went one year, and then I went the next year with her. And we always commented on how few women were in that audience. And today, that organization is 55 women, 45 men.
Huh.
And Bob Gentry, again, he mentored me and said, well, you should get involved with this organization. And he put me on a minority and women's committee. And we tried to develop a plan to broaden the representation for some of those folks. And I think some of that ultimately worked. And then again, Eric Rudy had been active in this group from Wisconsin, and he got me to run for national office.
Hmm.
And I won.
What office?
I was treasurer of the council for 3 years. And you're on the board, of course, when that happens, mm-hmm. and learned more about the organization and the differences. I had some fun in that there was a staff member. We had one staff member in Washington. They now have like 12, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she called and said there was a conference room table on sale in a store down the street from where they were in Washington. And it was a good deal. And I said, do we really need a new conference table? And she said, yes. And I said, well, okay. And she called me back an hour later and said, they'll deliver it tomorrow. And I just was blown out of the water dealing with the university's purchase.
Professionalist organizations and associations.
Oh, and that I was on the Incure board, and we hired another individual while I was there and moved the office in Washington. So this all kind of took time away from work. Fortunately, I had a good staff and that was willing to work a little extra to make all that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave you the opportunity to talk to every school in the country. Almost, it's really, any school was doing research. And yes, Wisconsin's always been in the top five nationally. And people wanted to know what we were doing. But at the same time, the interchange really helped you. It solidified your own thoughts on whether what you thought you were doing was right. It would give you new ideas, new ways to approach things. You always brought something back from those meetings. And I think becoming more involved even helped me with some of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Even more. people never hesitated to call. And as a result, I never hesitated to call if I needed help to get some new ideas. There's another, and then I was chair of, there are regional organizations, and I was chair of the region. And then I served again on the board and was a one-year temporary treasurer. They had the treasurer became the president, and they had to have somebody fill in. So they brought me back. So I guess I was still doing okay. They keep bringing me back. But the region gave me an outstanding service award in the early 90s, and Cura gave me an outstanding award in 2001. And then there's another group, which is called the Society of Research Administrators, and it has a slightly different mix. It has more med schools involved in it than Cura. And I've done some panel and made some presentations to those. And then you have the Federal Demonstration Project I already talked about. Mm-hmm. That brought all kinds of new things to the campus. That was really a working group. It was an important group to be part of, as the Council of Government Relations is. And you needed, if you're going to be a major research institution, you needed some of those outlets to keep current. You would hear, particularly at Coker, you'd hear more early on what anyone in the federal government was thinking about. And it was important to maybe even fend some of it off in there. And then from the grad school side, there's the Association of Graduate Schools and the Council of Graduate Schools. And they each meet once a year. And the council was much more oriented towards student activities. And there was a period of time there when I said I was working with Lorraine Meithaler. In those meetings, again, you'd find out what other schools were up to. Some of the formal presentations didn't stimulate you, but the conversation you got out in the hall or at dinner or lunch or even in the hospitality suite, that's where you really learn the most. Mm-hmm. And it was, they were very important to me anyway. I'm not sure I would have been as successful as I was if I hadn't. And you hadn't done that. You'd transfer some of those things you learned too. You know, something worked in, just like I said with the taxes, something would work with Incura, and so you'd try it with FDP, or I'd even try it with the budget staff. I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those things ended up being just part of you.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of awards that you'd received. Could you talk about those a little in more detail, and then talk about the other honors and awards that you received mm-hmm. over the years? And I know there are many.
Well, the Incura award is for the Outstanding Research Administrator. They give one a year, and I was chosen in 2001. I was very proud of that accomplishment, particularly as I was thinking about retiring and what have you.
So are you nominated for that?
Yes, somebody nominates you, and then you need two letters of recommendation from members of Incura. I was working for Virginia Henshaw, who was the dean, and she was the one that was convinced that I had to get it. And I know she was responsible for putting it together. You don't do it yourself. Somebody mm-hmm. has to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And Virginia was also the one responsible for the campus. I got the University of Wisconsin-Madison award for leadership, mm-hmm. excellence in leadership, I guess it was called. And Ginger was the nominator for that. And again, that one, you had to have four supporting letters, I think, from mm-hmm. faculty and colleagues and peers across the campus. The Incura region has a Distinguished Service Award, which I won in 1989. What other things? I was brought in as an honorary member in the School of Business Professional Fraternity. I didn't pledge it when I was in school. I was state independent. And there's a local Madison group, and they've made me an honorary member of that. And I was in all the who's who's. Who's who of America, who's who of the Midwest, who's who of American women, who's who in the world, and then who's who in American education. And I ended up in enjoying a fair amount of recognition that way. And and I worked with the UW Credit Union, and they had a University Credit Union Ambassador of the Year. First you're the Ambassador of the Month, and then you're the Ambassador of the Year. So I had an opportunity to serve in those respects. And I guess those are the honors. I've held office. I was Vice President of this University Insurance Association for 10 years. I served on that board for 20 years. That was, you're elected.
I voted for you.
Oh, good. And that was another one. They called and said that they wanted somebody to run, and that it was been a faculty group, and they wanted somebody to break the mold and be academic staff.
Sure.
And would I be willing to have my name put up? That I can't remember. It might have been Carla Rotz and Steve Lund that thought I had enough name recognition that it might work.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. And I was the first woman. And the first academic staff member on that particular board.
Did you feel like you fit in though right away? No problems with being the first woman and the first academic staff?
The academic staff was a bigger problem than the woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think the woman part was fine. It was a bunch of faculty from the School of Business. Many of them knew my name and knew me.
Is that a system-wide committee?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it is. It was a question of whether the insurance professors should really be the ones controlling everything, I think, more than anything else. But once I saved them on the income taxes, then it was okay.
Uh-huh. Did you feel any discrimination as academic staff on campus?
Rarely. Every once in a while, you'd run into a faculty member that was kind of, I'd rather talk to a fellow academician. Some of the compliance issues, I have to admit, in the last 5 years that I was working, every once in a while somebody would say, well, a faculty member really should be the one that tells a faculty member they have to do this.
Oh, really?
That they might not like it coming from an academic staff member. Many of the faculty did not feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while you would find one, I think, that... And sometimes I would agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was more important that the university get to where it needed to go than to get hung up on this.
Right.
But I think this was rare, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, it wasn't academic staff. I think early on it was more the woman's voice on the end of the phone telling the male faculty principal investigator rather than it was academic staff than that. So I was very fortunate. I was in positions where I wasn't surrounded with that kind of attitude or people. And when people from outside the grad school or the research activities, the research offices, I came in contact with, respected it enough that I didn't feel it at all.
Yeah. Well, now we get to the final group of questions, life after work. Oh. If you would talk about your family, what you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working. What are you doing now in retirement? How do you keep yourself healthy? Do you miss not being on campus?
Well, let me take that one first. I don't miss not being on campus. I miss some of my colleagues. It was kind of fun to interact and work with those. And I miss a little bit of some of that groundbreaking knowledge that would occur.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing about the stem cell stuff 3 years before it hit.
Wow.
you know, and that was kind of always kind of fun.
Sure.
We were in on with space science and engineering when they took the first picture of the Earth, you know, with the spin span camera. And that kind of maybe in feeling or something.
Sure.
Always made you feel good. But other than that, I'm saddened sometimes when you read the bad reports in the paper, mm-hmm. but I'm also smart enough to know that's not the full story, always, mm-hmm. in there. So, that's where it is. What am I doing? What did I do? And what am I doing?
Yeah, what did you do?
Pretty much a lot of it's the same.
Uh-huh.
I love to ski. And did a lot of that. I went every winter. While we were working. Unfortunately, I had surgery. I had a herniated disc in my neck, and I skied a couple years after that, and now in retirement, I think it's a little dangerous. If I fall really hard, I could be in trouble. So I've given the skiing up, and in its place, I've gotten more serious about playing golf in the summer. And I read more than I ever did.
Have
time. The time I didn't. I enjoy a good mystery actually. In working, I had so many other things I was reading. Reading for pleasure, just there wasn't any time left for that. And I like to hike and travel a lot. I've always had a travel bug. My father used to tease me when I was 17 years old about traveling. So, and I still have that. And I have my older sister is in Arizona now full time, and my brother's in Rancho Mirage outside of Palm Springs.
Oh, those are nice places to visit.
And perfect places to visit, and particularly when it's cold here.
Yeah.
And they're both, my sister has a spare bedroom with my name on it, and my brother has a casita, which is a separate little house,
uh-huh.
and a swimming pool in the front yard and a hot tub. He lived in Los Angeles while he was working. He ended up flying for United Airlines. And when he retired, decided that he didn't need the hustle and bustle of the big city, so he moved further east, but not out of California. He fled from Chicago 1 year after it, where it was 28 inches of snow. So I'm the only one of the family really has stuck it out in the winter. But I like winter, and I've always liked winter sports. I'd like to do a little more snowshoeing or something, but we
mm-hmm.
don't get enough snow.
No.
And I like to travel and break the winter up. I mean, a trip to somewhere, to the sun, and then come back here for a while, and then go to the sun again.
Where are some of your favorite places that you've traveled?
That I travel. Oh. I like to go to where there's a lot of nature. I enjoyed Alaska a lot. I've done some, with the Alumni Association, got into some wildlife tours that they have offered. One was to Churchill for polar bears and Yellowstone in January when it's 20 below zero. For wolves, we found all kinds of wolves. Yellowstone was just so picturesque in the winter with the frost all over everything from the geysers and things.
Mm-hmm.
And we went for, the guide volunteered to take us all for an evening walk into the geyser basin one night, and it turned out the moon had set, and so the stars were just there. Oh, I've never seen so many. It was just magical. It really was.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back, Old Faithful went off for us.
Oh, my.
And that same group we went to, last summer we went to Bella Coola, British Columbia, and went grizzly bear watching. And next summer that group is going to go to Newfoundland for whales and birds. Puffins, they're my favorite bird.
Now, where haven't you been that you want to go to?
Oh, I want to go to Galapagos Islands. And I'd like to go down under. I would like to go to New Zealand and Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I originally thought I wanted to go to the Orient, but right now I'm not so sure I want to go there. They get their bird flu under control, maybe. But
yeah.
And then I love to go in the wintertime. I like to go somewhere warm. You know, I'm really a fan of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. I've been there a lot.
The questions are over, but is there something you'd like to say to add to the tape before we turn it off?
Oh, maybe only that I really feel like I've been very fortunate. The university's been a great place to work. It has been very supportive of me, and I wish it all, as an alum, I especially wish it all the best and forward movement that it can handle.
Well, thank you very much. This was an excellent interview, and I'm so glad you agreed to do it.
Oh,
thank you.
It was my pleasure.
There is one more thing we want to add to this tape. Go ahead.
I just wanted to talk about how the bombing affected everything.
Yes.
And I was living at the time on the south side of Madison and woke up in the middle of the night thinking it was raining because there was this rumble. And we were 6-7 miles away. And when you got back to campus and I was walking toward Bascom Hall, at the time I was carpooling to the Space Science Building, and then I'd walk up the hill, and there were all these police, and there was shambles. They weren't going to necessarily even let me get to work. And we got up there, and I found out what had been going on, and it was but 2 days later, they announced that Bob Borchers, who is the supervisor, the prof of FOSNOT, was going to try administration. And Heinz Barshall, who was the senior faculty member, was going to move to the engineering campus. And they both left physics at that point in time. And Bob came and was associate dean for the physical sciences in the graduate school, which put him, he never went back to research. That just totally changed his life. Hmm. He went from there to vice chancellor at Madison, vice chancellor at Colorado, associate director of Lawrence Livermore Labs out in California, to assistant director of National Science Foundation, where he retired.
Huh.
And it's just amazing what these kinds of things do to you.
Mm-hmm.
In that, mm-hmm. it really totally calmed the campus down too.
Yeah, right.
It just leveled it. It was really an experience to go through. Mm-hmm. I know. It's hard for me to believe that the students on campus now have no idea and no memory of any of that.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, thank you for adding that. I'm glad we got it on.